Good afternoon. So let's start with an exercise that should be a review of things we covered last time. And here I'm asking us to look at where we have to do forwarding installs for a pipeline that is not our five-stage pipeline. Hopefully I did not just break. Okay. So how are we going to do that? So I have this idea on this slide that probably we want a pipeline diagram. Okay. So we're going to start by making a pipeline diagram. And what I'm going to say is, okay, so we want to figure out where we have forwarding and dependencies as part of this. So one thing I'm going to observe here is that I'm writing 2R9 here, and I need that value for the next instruction. So that's going to be a constraint on when I can run the instruction. If we didn't have any constraints, what I'd want to do is I just want to run it right away, right afterwards. That's sort of how our pipeline naturally operates. We fetch the next instruction after we fetch the previous one, what we've been learning. But we have a hazard here, and namely, we want to get in time for us to use it in the execute step to do a addition. We want to get the value of 09 from instruction 1. And instruction 1, it's not going to compute that value in time. So the first thing we need to do is we need to say, well, then we can't do that. So I'm going to say, can't start executing this instruction. We're going to delay the execute by 1 cycle. So the value is available in time. So now we don't need it yet. And then I'm going to do some forwarding of the value. Some questions? How I figured out this sort of what timing of instruction 2, so that we have to do a stall and that we're doing forwarding. So then I have instruction 3, and we also have a dependency in instruction 3, which we're going to have to worry about later. But first, let's try to place instruction 3 in our timeline. So I'm going to follow my same practice that I'm going to fetch the next instruction right after the previous one. And then I run into a problem that our previous instruction is still in decode. We can't have two things in decode. There's only one register file. We can't do two instructions at once in our design. So this instruction is going to be stuck behind in fetch. Then it can move on to decode. And if there's nothing, no problems with that dependency, we can just keep going on. So then we need to check the dependency that we need for this third add, the value of R9. The value of R9 is computed at the end of cycle 3. We need it by the beginning of cycle 5. We can resolve that with forwarding only. We don't need any additional stalling to make that happen. Then I have a move queue instruction here that's writing to memory. And we have one dependency from, we need the value of RBX for the address we're writing to. And we have another dependency, which is that we need this new value of R9 for it. So potentially, we might have to forward both of these values rather than getting it from the register file to see if that's the case. We'll look at sort of running our instruction naturally. So we're going to have it be fetched right after the other previous instruction was successfully fetched. So we can't do that earlier because we can't fetch two things at the same time. We only have one instruction cache thing here. And then we're going to hope that we can just go through our stages in order. So then I'm going to start by looking at R9. We want the value of R9 to write to memory. We don't need to do any calculations on it. So I need it by the beginning of cycle 8. So that I can resolve with forwarding. The value of R9 is computed at the end of cycle 6, so I can forward it here or here to make that happen. We also want the value of RBX, and the value of RBX is computed at the end of cycle 5. We need it, arguably, we need it by the beginning of cycle 6 because we need to add 0 to it to compute the address. Or maybe if we're clever, we need it only by the memory stage. But in either case, we can forward it at the end of cycle 5. Questions? Yes.
How can you move like register 9's value like so right before E2? I'm like, wouldn't that be too late?
Question, wouldn't this be too late? So what we're gonna do is we're gonna have a bogus value we read from the register file going through our pipeline, and we're just gonna replace that in the middle. And why is that okay? Well, because we only use the value in this memory stage. So if you look at this instruction, R9 is never used for any math stuff, and that's what we're doing in execute. So execute is just passing a bogus value through. We'll just ignore that value and replace it with the forwarded one.
So it doesn't even, is that why you do the also the arrow to the right, and you have to have it during execute rather than right after?
Is that why I drew these two? Yeah, it could happen in either place. As long as the value is available to be forwarded, and it gets there before memory, it's good enough for this case.
But not every operation we can do that, right?
But not every operation we can do that, yes. So for example, if we had, like, if this was another add, we can't do that because it's too late to get the value now, right? We can't give an updated value and expect that if we already started adding to it, for example. But fortunately, we're not doing that for this move instruction.
You have to stall.
In that case, we would have to stall, yes. Other questions? Yeah.
So for instruction 3, when you mentioned that, instruction 4, when you mentioned that we can directly fetch it after the previous instruction, and you said because the register can only hold one thing, like what do you mean by the register can only hold one thing?
What do I mean by the register can only hold one thing? I think the instruction cache like can only fetch one thing at a time. So we have to wait. So like it doesn't matter. So we can't like take advantage of the fact that we fetched instruction 3 during cycle 2 and not fetch it again. We don't have any place to store instruction 3 while the instruction head of it is stalling, other than like in the registers between fetch and decode. So we're not going to be able to fetch the instruction earlier, even though it might look like it. Or does that make sense? So, yeah, I would say instruction 3 is using the fetch stage stuff.
Yeah.
So we can't use it yet. We would need to add extra machinery in order to make the fetch stage be available sooner, which we're not going to do because it turns out doesn't actually save us any time because we'll run into the problem in a later stage, the same thing, that we can't like have two things in the decode stage or two things doing the math at the same time. So they have to go one behind another. Question, the reason there's two fetch stages is because we have the two decode stages? Yes. So I have two decode stages because I assumed we're going to detect in decode that, oh, I can't actually read registers and we're going to repeat the stage. If we do that, then the instruction behind it is stuck in the fetch stage. Other questions? Yeah.
So is that like an alternative to a no-op or some, like, because I saw before, like,
So question, is this an alternative to a no-op? So there is secretly a no-op happening here, and I'll make that clearer by going to my full answer and writing something that we didn't write down that's going on here. And that's that, well, when we have this decode happening twice, what is really happening is we have kind of a no-op that starts in execute one where I should actually put it above. We have a no-op that basically replaces where the second add instruction that would normally go through the pipeline. So it goes through execute one, execute two, memory, and write back. So they're doing something, they're doing a no-op. So we do actually have an insert of no-op, it's just kind of hidden in this diagram. So yes, this really is still the stalling you mentioned where we're inserting a no-op. We're just doing it in kind of maybe an unexpected place. Other questions? Okay, so that will serve as our through forwarding and data hazards. When we finished last time, we mentioned that we were going to be dealing with one more type of hazards, which are hazards with conditional jumps, where we can't know what piece of code to run next. And if we have some code like this, we need to get the result of the comparison, and then we actually need to apply that. And I'm going to assume, for the purposes of these slides, that we need the jump to have an execute stage before we could figure out what to actually fetch. That the jump is going to look at the flags, and that's going to be done in the execute stage, not earlier. Hypothetically, maybe we could do that a little earlier, but in either case, we're not going to do it fast enough because, well, the comparison definitely, in this example, isn't done until near the end of cycle two, and we want to, if we were doing nothing, we want to fetch after the jump at the beginning of cycle two. So the comparison is happening too late for us to fetch in time. So in this example, I'm solving that problem by stalling, that I'm inserting some no-op instructions instead of fetching something because I don't know what to fetch yet. And I, in this example, take two cycles to figure out what to fetch, and then I fetch it. And that's assuming we set the flags, we compute where the jump actually goes, and then finally I can use that result and fetch it. And it seems like we can't do much better than this because at the least we need the comparison to happen before we can do the conditional jump. We can't do any faster than that. But we are going to have a fix to make this hazard usually not a problem. And that's going to be making a guess that we're going to have our code here, and when we run it, we're not just going to run our compare, our jump, and then we're going to spend two cycles waiting, and then we're going to go to one of these two places. Instead, what we're going to do is we're going to spend our two cycles doing something. So for example, maybe we'll guess that the jump won't happen. So we'll just start executing those two instructions, and then we'll figure out where the jump should actually go. And if we're right, we do nothing. We've started executing those two instructions. That's exactly what we should have done. And we just do nothing. Nothing extra. We already handled the jump. If we're wrong, we just need to undo these instructions in progress and execute the thing we're really supposed to execute. And we will execute that a little later than we would if we guessed that instead. But, that's the same penalty we would have taken anyways if we used the stalling solution. Yes?
So assuming that undoing a step requires a step, would it be possible to have to do the stall once and then do half of it so that it would always be the same speed?
So question, assuming that undoing requires a step, would it be possible to do a compromise? Possibly. It's going to turn out, especially for this five-stage pipeline, that undoing the instruction is essentially free.
Okay.
And we will discuss why that is. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so let's look at how this works out. So when we speculate right, it's as if that wasn't a conditional jump. It just works. We don't have any delays. And when we speculate wrong, what we're basically going to do is we're going to fetch these wrong instructions, and then we're going to do what's called squashing them. That's undoing them. And in a five-stage pipeline, all we really have to do is replace them with no ops in the pipeline. So rather than sending the XOR from decode to execute, we replace all its stuff with a no op. And rather than sending the move from fetch to decode, we replace all its stuff with a no op. And in our five-stage pipeline, we don't actually modify anything until the execute stage. So this is, you know, all we need to do. We don't need to do any other bookkeeping. In a more complicated pipeline, yes, undoing the instruction would have some extra steps. We need to do some extra bookkeeping to make that happen, and possibly it wouldn't be sort of as free as it is here. But in the five-stage pipeline, you know, we need the logic to replace this, to decide whether to send a no-op or the real instruction. That's it. Questions on our timeline when we predict instructions wrong. So we have this idea that we should predict where the instructions go, and I mentioned that just predicting anything is going to help us. But processors are often very concerned because it helps a lot if we predict correctly and doesn't help at all if we don't, about making good predictions. And we're going to talk a little bit about sort of very basic strategies for making good predictions. And I'm going to start with probably the best strategy for making predictions that's what we'll call static, that doesn't use information about what actually happened in the program. And that's the strategy forward not taken, backwards taken. So we're going to assume that jumps that go to a future line are not taken, and that jumps that go to a prior line, a lower address, are taken. And the intuition behind this is that this perfectly predicts loops that go on forever. So if we have a loop that goes on forever, you know, a jump backwards, that's going back to the beginning of the loop, that's taken. And if we have a loop that goes on forever, a jump forwards, will never be taken. And since most real programs, it turns out, have loops that are executed a bunch of times, this is a pretty good strategy and gets you a relatively high rate of correct predictions without very much work at all. Okay, so questions on the static prediction strategy. Yeah?
So are you saying, like, just generally in code, the majority of jumps are to loops, or in part of loops?
Question, in code, the majority of jumps are to loops. A majority, I guess, in practice, most executed jumps are for part of loops. So it's not necessarily the case that, like, if you look at a program like machine code and count the jump instructions, that most of them will be for loops, but most of our program's time is spent in loops because those things run lots of times. So that's what matters the most in practice for most programs. Yeah?
So is it possible that the first conditional jump is not fully checked yet, but the second condition currently started? For example, if you are running a loop and inside the loop there's only one instruction, which is pretty fast, so in the first loop we are checking the condition and then you start
So your question is, could I have it be the case that when I predict what instructions to run, that instead of running kind of an ordinary instruction for my prediction, I end up running another jump instruction and predict that? Absolutely. And that's not a problem. It may make the logic for undoing mispredictions a little more complicated, but processors deal with that and do it. Yeah.
Contents, like if a loop would go 1,000 times, it only goes like 250 times, and it just does the process 4 times in a row.
it's faster, I thought, because of it had less jumps, but in this situation, it seems like it wouldn't be faster. How would those two things be different?
So the question is, you've heard that if you want to make your code faster, one way to do that is to reduce the number of jump instructions. Doesn't this violate the intuition that it helps? So no, and I think the simplest reason to say why is that with our prediction, the jump instruction still basically took a cycle, right? If we got rid of this jump instruction, it would still be a cycle faster. It just took a cycle instead of three cycles, so it still took time. Other questions? Okay, so this is one way of making those guesses, and it turns out with just a strategy, like for many real programs, we can be like 70%+ correct. Now, it turns out modern processors are going to depend a lot more on branch prediction, and that's partly because their pipeline, as we'll discuss later, is going to be way more complicated than the 5-stage pipeline. And they're going to want branch prediction rates which are like 99%+. And you need something more complicated. And we're not going to talk about like the fully more complicated things, but to give you an idea of the sort of things processors do, I'm going to talk about probably the simplest strategy that uses history to predict branches, since that's the sort of main way processors make good branch predictions, is that they don't just make a guess based on the code statically, they look at how the program executed in the past. So one way of implementing this is to have a little table that might be something like a cache. And to look up into that table, we'll take the address of our conditional jump instruction and pass it into a hash function of some sort, often a very simple hash function, like taking, say, you know, some bits of the address. And we'll have a table telling us, given that, what was the last result of a branch that hashed to that slot. And we will use this as our prediction. And the idea here is, again, with loops, typically we'll only have one branch in the loop that maps to that slot. And that will be our prediction, will be what happened to it last time. And typically, the branches in a loop or other code that runs repeatedly will stay the same. So this will usually be correct, is our hope. And we'll use that as our prediction. And then we'll actually execute this instruction and we'll figure out, well, was that prediction correct? Was this taken? Did we actually jump to the target or did we keep going? And we'll use that result to update the table after the conditional jump instruction runs. So, for example, I have some code here with this conditional jump instruction, which we can sort of work out where it came from and see. But, you know, let's say I starts out as predicting not taken, and it's actually taken, so we'll have a misprediction. You know, so we'll predict it first, then we'll figure out what actually happens, and we'll update the table. Then the next time the loop runs, we're going to predict that it was taken because we updated the table. And that's nice for this loop because the loop is going to do the same thing over and over again, and our prediction will be correct. And it will keep being correct until we get to the end of the loop, it turns out, when we will make an incorrect prediction. You know, we'll predict it as taken because it was taken the last time in the loop, but now we're at the end of the loop, so it's not going to be taken. We will update our table to say that. And then we will mispredict again the first time the loop runs another, you know, if this loop gets to run again, assuming nothing else happens in the table. And so this idea is that basically we're just using a simple little bit of remembering what happened in the past, and there's some more sophisticated versions of this. So one thing you might notice here is that, you know, I always predict wrong, you know, the first and last time. I could do better than that by realizing if I see it not taken just once, I shouldn't like always predict it not taken the next time. I should wait for that to happen more than once. And that would be an example of something we could do here, but we need to store more stuff in this table to do that. But a lot of processor techniques are basically, you know, something like a table of what happened last time for our instructions like this, you know, where they're going to store, or maybe not just the last time, last few times, but we're using sort of the past results of the program to predict what will happen in the future. And that usually works out pretty well. Of course, I could write a program that deliberately makes this not work out, but that's not the programs we're writing. We're writing programs that have kind of natural patterns of behavior. Some questions about this simple prediction strategy? Yeah?
Wait, so is the convention to just predict what happened last, or the opposite, like always do taken, or like is there a convention?
So is the convention, so in this strategy, we're just, because of what we're storing, we can just only predict what happened last. There, we could imagine doing more work where instead of just saying, writing that, like what happened last, we could write like what happened the last couple times. Then we can make a more intelligent guess, right? So if I, instead of having taken here, if I said, you know, taken three times, not taken one time, right? I could make a better prediction, and processors will do things like that to make better predictions than this very simple strategy. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so a complaint you might have about this is I'm kind of assuming that we have this hash function, and in this example I was saying, well, only one thing is using that slot in our table. And of course, in practice, for a large program, that doesn't happen. You know, we'll have two branches go to the same table entry. And unlike, like say, a cache, we actually don't have any way of telling. And this is not an uncommon strategy because, well, we just say, will anything really go wrong if we're using the prediction from the wrong branch? And often it won't. Sometimes it will be better because, you know, if it happens to map to the same thing as something that's where both of them work the same way, where both of them are usually taken, we'll get better predictions. If they're conflicting, yeah, we'll get worse predictions. But notice the only sort of problem with having, you know, one entry in our table shared between two different branches is we get sort of less performance. There's no correctness issue. It's not like a cache where if we read the wrong thing from the cache, our program is very angry at us for giving it the wrong number. We're just going to run slower. Okay, so let's start through a little exercise on this. So let's say I have this loop here, and I'm using that sort of simple history predictor. What's the misprediction rate for this? who'd like some more time? Okay, a few people. And I'll have my hint is I would make a table like this. Okay, so who thinks that I'm going to ask for mispredictions? Who thinks that it's going to be predicted incorrectly less than a third of the time? Okay, how about predicted incorrectly less than two-thirds of the time? Okay, how about two-thirds or more of the time? Okay, so we have a split. So I would say it's around two-thirds of the time. So let's work out this. So if I look at my example, zero is a bit of an issue, right? Because we need to figure out, well, what's the initial prediction? And the problem, we have the strategy for doing that, which is that I'm assuming that there's some loop around this that runs this a whole bunch of times. So then the actual prediction is going to be based on whatever happens when I equals 49, which happened like before. I should probably put that up here, right? When I equals 49, we did this. And when I equals 49, well, what happens? Well, 49 mod 3 is not 0, so the outcome was false. So our prediction is going to be initially false. And so that is not correct. And then for one, we're going to predict it based on what happened with zero. It's going to be not, and that's going to be wrong. We're going to predict that, yes, it's going to be taken. It's no, it's not going to be taken. So we have one incorrect, two incorrects. And then for two, well, we're going to predict it based on one. Those are both false, so that's going to be correct. And basically, we're going to have this pattern of wrong, wrong, right, right, wrong, and so on, all the way up to 49. So we actually get about two-thirds wrong, and then it depends sort of what our sort of, you know, whether we have a little extra from the beginning and end. I believe we do, yes. So the question is, how would we try to predict it the first time it runs? And this varies on the processor. So in this problem, I told you that this was executed many, many times in a loop, so we'd assume we'd have some prior run to use. If we didn't, most likely a processor would use some static prediction, like the forwards not taken, backwards taken, or maybe even a simpler static predictor like not taken, or always not taken, always taken. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah, sorry, I should amend that. So, or alternately, if you remember our table here, we had just had something in there, right? So it might just use some data from other instructions in the program that happen to fill in the same table entry. So we might have a random kind of prediction based on other stuff in the program. And then let's do this also for the other conditional branch here. And what I'll get for that is that the pattern we have here is that when I equals 1, you know, this was last run with I equals 49 when it was taken, or I equals 50, sorry, when it was taken. So if predicate is taken, it will be not taken. That's a incorrect. Then we'll predict it as not taken, and that will be correct, and that will be true for 2 all the way up to 49. And then when I equals 50, we'll predict it as not taken, and that will be incorrect, because it will actually be taken. So we'll have 2 incorrect predictions for 50 numbers and 48 correct ones. And so we get, if we actually want to figure out the overall rate, we can get that we have, that this loop with that sort of simple static predictor gets a 64% prediction rate. Even with how horribly the if statement is predicted, like having a loop, you know, made it work out pretty well. And our assumption here is that we have some sort of table and the 2 branch instructions hash to different places, so they have independent predictions. If they didn't, well, that would make things a little uglier. Yeah? Question, if they're correct for the same I, do they count as 2 correct predictions? Yes. If we're thinking about the assembly, right, if they're both correct, we've saved, with our 5-stage pipeline, 2 cycles for each of them. So we want to definitely count them separately. Yeah?
So do, like, would you be able to basically know this table before running code and then subsequently, like, change your pattern of predicting, or do you have to first, like, see how inefficient it is?
Question, would you be able to know this table for running code? By you, do you mean someone writing code or someone making a processor? Or, like, the processor? Someone making a processor? No, because, you know, you have to run the code to, like, fill in the table. I would say processors typically have way more complicated branch predictors than the ones I'm showing here. Which is where they get sort of much better efficiency in practice, right? So most current, like, desktop or laptop processors, if you run this loop lots of times, they probably have a greater than 99% prediction accuracy. And obviously they're doing something pretty complicated to make that happen. Other questions? Yeah. How are we reaching the break of 49 out of 3? We have 49 here, and then we go to here.
Isn't 49 mod 3 non-zero?
Yes, and that's fine. We go here, and we end up here after the if, regardless.
Oh, regardless.
You know, either through the dot 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 code or directly. So that's how we're always reaching it. Doesn't matter. This is go to here. It's not go to somewhere outside the loop. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so again, kind of the basic idea of what I say is dynamic branch prediction. We're gonna predict what the code does based on observing it in the past. There's a few holes I'm missing. So here I'm showing you that we're gonna predict yes or no. And that's a very common task, but that's not the only thing we need to do. We also need to deal with, you know, cases where we have, like, a jump to a label, and we need to figure out where that label is. And that might take some time, especially if our fetch stage is more than one cycle, or maybe it's not a normal jump, but it's a jump that is based on a register. Or we have a rect or a call or something like that. So what are some solutions for that? And we're going to want some predictors for not just whether something is a jump is taken or not, but we also want to predict where it will go. So one idea we could have for that is that this idea of a branch target buffer, which is basically a cache, but instead of caching, like, data values in memory or page table entries, we're going to cache where branches went. And we'll use this to predict what instruction to fetch. If we got the wrong prediction from here, well, we'll just undo those instructions and go back. So in this example, we have this call instruction here, and we'll just have a cached entry here telling us where that call went the last time we ran it. And we can use that to immediately fetch that instruction, even if we can't figure out that it's a call instruction and exactly where it goes right away. Questions? And I guess I won't talk about them in detail, but we can also, another thing we can do is we can have some specialized sort of memory of recent calls for return instructions to predict those quickly. Or we can just like have a table saying where it returned to last. Either way, we can get like sensible predictions, even in cases where we can't figure out where does the jump go to. So questions on branch prediction before, because I think this is, we're going to move on to topics where we're going to more apply, assuming we have the branch prediction. Okay, so in talking about wanting to have this cache for instructions that, you know, we fetched recently, like how they decoded and all that, you know, I'm alluding to that we want to have sort of more complicated pipelines. And there's like two big things that the more complicated pipelines that we actually see in modern laptop, desktop, mobile phone processors do. And we're going to talk about how we implement both of them. So one of them is that they're what we'll call multiple issue. They start issue multiple instructions at a time. So if we have some assembly here, rather than running fetching one instruction at a time and decoding, you know, reading registers for one instruction at a time and doing the arithmetic for one instruction at a time, they'll do multiple instructions at a time. So in this diagram, I have two. It turns out modern, like, laptop or desktop processors can do, like, the arithmetic or loading and fetch storing for around 4 to 6 instructions at a time at most. Maybe up to, like, 8. And kind of a simple way of thinking about it is they're kind of like just have multiple parallel pipelines. But then we have like hazards that come a lot more complicated here, right? So in this diagram here, I have showing the forwarding we need to do, and boy, is it a lot more. And another thing that was some people asked about earlier was that, well, when we would have stalls, we want to find extra work to do. So for example, I mentioned that caches, you know, that when we have a cache miss, it's kind of slow. So here I have a move instruction that's kind of slow. And what I'd really like to do is while we're waiting for R8 to be fetched from this cache, I don't want to hold up all the other instructions. I want to find work to do. But that means I have to run these instructions out of order. So I'd really like to run this add and XOR instruction that don't care about R8. But to do that, I need to run the instructions in an order other than the one they're written in the program. And the big benefit of this is that this means when we have things like caches that are sometimes slow and sometimes not, we can run programs kind of fast regardless by finding instructions to run, rather than having our processor always wait for the cache when it's slow, you know, or requiring the compiler to somehow design our code so it never waits for the cache. So questions about these sort of two ideas. You know, we want to run multiple instructions at once and want to run them out of order when, you know, so we don't have to wait for values to be available. We want to find instructions we can run now. Yeah.
Is this the reason why sometimes in the C language, if you do the printout debugging method, it doesn't work?
Question, is this the reason why print debugging doesn't work? No. So the processor is going to implement all this functionality in a way that's invisible to you as an assembly programmer. So even though our instruction is going to run in a different order, you as a programmer are not going to be able to tell, because the processor is going to do all the bookkeeping to make it appear as if the instructions run one after the other. Yes? This is not the same as multi-core. This is something done in addition to multi-core. Yes.
So if you have alternate instructions, when would you ever stall?
Question, if you have alternate instructions, when would you ever stall? So as we'll probably allude to either this later today or probably next time, it turns out in many real programs that even when we do this, we still run out of instructions to run. That they just don't, there's just not enough work to do. Yeah?
Why in cycle 8 can we have 2 instructions?
Why in cycle 8 can we have 2 instructions in the write stage? I am assuming we've already done this thing here to some extent. But if we hadn't, yes, we'd have to like paste them out somehow. Okay, other questions? Okay. So we want to do these instructions that run out of order, and we want to run multiple instructions at a time. And this makes our hazard handling way more complicated. And we're going to want a different strategy for doing like forwarding and so on, because reasoning about forwarding, you know, for this sort of example is really complicated. We want some way of making it manageable. So we're going to have a systematic way of doing it. We're going to call register renaming. And to motivate that, I'm going to give examples of some of the sort of hazard cases we're going to have to deal with. So in a normal pipeline, I have this code here that uses R8 a bunch. And we mentioned that, oh, I want to forward to the last add instruction, the most recent adds R8, not the previous one. But this same kind of logic like kind of breaks down if we're thinking about a out of order processor, that if I just forward from execute to decode, that might be the wrong add instruction. So I need to somehow track which one's more recent. We have an example here where I want to forward this 100 for the move. I do not want to forward this value here that is unrelated to the R8 I care about for the last add. Questions on. Yeah. So this tells me I can't just use what stage am I forwarding from? That's not good enough. It's not going to tell me what to do. So, what we're going to do to figure out where to forward from is we're going to track that there are different versions of the registers. So, we can look at this code and say, we have actually a bunch, three different versions of R8 here. Four different versions, really. I'll show you that. And we're just wanting to track separate that they're separate versions explicitly. Rather than saying, I want to forward R8, we're going to say, I want to forward a particular version of R8. So I can take my assembly code here that uses add, and rather than just saying R8, I'm going to say what this first add instruction really is it adds R10 to R8 version 1 and puts the result in R8 version 2. The next add adds R11 to R8 version 2 and puts the result in R8 version 3. And then that last add takes R12 and R8 version 3 and puts the result in R8 version 4. And if I write the instruction this way, then the decision about what do I forward is actually simpler. I just look for the matching R8 version. Right, I'm going to forward this, the correct version. And nothing else is a candidate for forwarding. The version has to match exactly. And if I do this type of tracking, that resolves our situation here, because what I'm going to say I have here is that this is here, I want to forward R8 version 3. The only place I can get that is this move instruction. Right. The red dotted line, that's taking a different version of R8 if I keep track of these version numbers. So that gives us a way of figuring out what to forward. And another thing we're going to realize here is that with an out-of-order pipeline, not only do we want to keep track of the different versions explicitly, turns out we often will need to store multiple versions of a register. Like, we actually want to keep them around. And as an example, here I have some code where I want to take this version, this first version of R8, sorry, here, and this R8 should go to the first move instruction, this R8 should go to the second move instruction, and this R8 should go to the add instruction. And I can have those instructions delayed in this way depending on what else is going on in my program. And that means I need to run this code, I need to simultaneously store three different values which are all in R8. They're just different versions of R8 because I'm writing this code in a different order than intended, means I need to actually track different values for R8 depending on which instruction is looking for R8. Because, well, when we ran this code one instruction at a time, there were different values of R8 at different times, and those instructions need those to match when they run. So one way we could try to deal with this problem is we could say, well, maybe I need to make sure I don't overwrite R8 with a new version until I've used the old version completely. That is indeed a solution, but it's not very efficient in practice. So what we're going to do in practice is we're going to store multiple copies of R8 in other registers that have multiple versions. We're just going to store all the versions. So how are we going to do that? We're going to make a really big register file. We're going to have tons of extra registers. So if we look at a typical laptop or desktop processor, you know, even a single core that's like executing our instructions with, you know, we think of having 16 registers for our assembly, they'll have like that implemented with often over 100 registers. And that's so we can store different versions of each of those sort of registers you see in assembly, so we can run multiple instructions from different parts of the program at the same time. Yes?
Would you need one slot for each step in your pipeline?
Would we need one slot for each step in our pipeline? We'll talk more about how the pipeline works. We'll need...
Like per register, would you need one register name version for each step?
You need one register version for each step in our pipeline? We'll assign the register versions more dynamically. We'll see exactly how that's done in a bit.
Are the registers, like, for that case, only used for that specific case? Like, they're only for rename or special registers?
Are these registers only for that case? So I would say this is how we're going to store, like, RAX through R15, is we're always going to store them in this way where we track what version it is. There's like, in the scheme I'm going to introduce, there's no sort of canonical version. Some processors do like have a separate storage for the like normal version, but you don't need to do that. And I think the simplest way to explain it is that this is the only way we store the values of our, you know, registers, RAX, RBX, and so on, is in this sort of big register file where we have different places we put different versions. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Does that mean there's a hard limit on the number of stages you can divide an instruction into?
Does that mean there's a hard limit on the number of stages you can divide an instruction into? There are some other limits on that. The number of registers we assign is going to limit sort of how far we can go out of order in executing things. And it's going to be one of the limitations on that. Since processors are using like 100 registers, it's usually not hundreds of over 100 registers, it's usually not the most important one. Important limitation. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
So like, is the only similarity between like R, whatever, register 8.1, register 8.2, like that they like one evolved into the other because they're effectively different completely?
Question. Is the only similarity that one involved to the other? Yes. So we're going to do a preprocessing step, you'll see, where we, you know, change them into something that looks completely unrelated, very deliberately. So now that we know this basic strategy, let me talk about how we build a processor with that. So we have this central idea, which is that we're going to do what's called register renaming. And I'm going to have some vocab terms here we're going to talk about. So we're going to name what I'll call architectural registers. These are registers in assembly, you see in assembly, to physical registers, that is the registers that actually exist on the physical processor. So we're going to rename those. And each version of an architectural register will get a different physical name. And then we'll compare the physical register names to do forwarding work. And because there's only one name for each version, we can just compare the registers. If they match, we can forward. If they don't match, we can't forward. There's no other logic we need. And it turns out this is also how we're going to track what instructions are done. So this is going to help us figure out when we can run instructions and so on. And so we'll have a pipeline where I have my sort of notional idea of a possible out-of-order pipeline here. So we have some things that look familiar. We have a fetch stage. We have our execute stage or stages. And we have a write back stage. But we have a few extra things. And probably the big thing is that we have a part of this pipeline here that runs out of order. So this part is out of order, and the rest is in order. So the in order parts are going to run in the order you expect code to run in assembly. And we're going to have this piece in the middle, which runs out of order, means it runs as values are ready to use. So we're going to have our order part. We're going to fetch our instruction. I have decode here. I don't mean reading registers. We're going to like figure out what the instruction's supposed to do. While we're doing this, we're going to do branch prediction, which for these processors is going to be actually pretty complicated. It might take multiple cycles. And then we're going to have this extra rename and dispatch step. So this step, we're going to do without register renaming. And we're going to take the instructions and put them in this instruction queue. So remember, this is our out of order part of our pipeline. So we have this queue of instructions, and we're not going to take things off the queue in order. We're going to take things off as they're ready to run, rather than the order they were put in. And we're going to track along with our instructions which registers have their values ready. And we're going to use that to determine what instructions can we run. Then we're going to do the actual register reading to get the values for the instructions. And then we're going to run them. And because we want to run multiple instructions at a time, we're going to have a whole bunch of what we'll call execution units, ALUs or data cache ports, so we can run multiple different instructions at once. We'll do a write back to actually take the values that these instructions produce and put them back in the register file. And we'll also update information about what values are ready so we can figure out, oh, now I can run this other instruction that depended on that and take that out of the instruction queue. So that's sort of the instruction running. And I said we're doing this all out of order. Now it turns out we need to kind of maintain the illusion that the program's still running like a normal program. So for example, if we have a seg fault in the middle of our program, we need to like run everything up to the seg fault, then tell the OS about it. So all that sort of logic is handled with this last stage I label as commit, and this reorder buffer, that's going to handle sort of doing the bookkeeping to make sure that everything appears to happen in order and dealing with things like what if there's a seg fault or some type of exception you know, how do we make sure everything is in a good state when that happens? And so what we'll end up with is we can kind of have a pipeline diagram where we'll have our processor. In this case, I'm assuming we kind of try to do two instructions at once. We're going to have our in-order part, so we're going to fetch all our instructions in order. In this case, I'm assuming we fetch two instructions at a time. On a kind of a modern laptop processor, often they'll fetch like 16 bytes of instructions at a time, so it might be 4 or 5. Then we'll do the decoding and renaming step. And then at this point, they're in the instruction queue. And we'll take things out of the instruction queue. And I'm going to call that step issuing the instructions. That's where we're going to read the registers for them and take them out of the instruction queue. And notice that we're not doing this in the order they appear in the program. We're changing the order based on when things are ready. So for example, this add of R2 to R5, I can't issue in cycle 3 yet because I need to actually forward the value from the first add to it. And so for that reason, I delayed it by one cycle. But this add of R3 and R4, I didn't need to delay because I didn't need to forward any values from prior instructions. And also, for example, this jump not equal, I had to issue that after the compare because it needs the comparison's results. But I could issue the next iteration's add instruction before that, which I predicted would run. If that prediction's wrong, I'm gonna need to do something about that to undo it. And then we have this final stage here where we do the commit. That's going to be in order, and that's going to be sort of doing all the bookkeeping to say this is really done. And also this is where we'll handle, like, what if one of these instructions like faulted? How do I make sure I do everything up to that so like your debugger looks right? Yes. Question, why aren't the I's lined up for these instructions? So my assumption here is that we only have two ALUs. And given that, I'm using one of them for the jump not equal and one of them for this add, so I can't do this other add at the same time. If we had more ALUs, I could probably do it. Does that answer your question? Okay, yeah. Same question, or? Okay. Okay, so I have our steps. Let's go to what happens in the register renaming step, which hopefully will also make clear what's going to happen in our instruction dispatch step. So I'm going to have some instructions. We're going to want to do it in this renaming step, which we do after we fetch the instruction, before we actually run it. I'm going to want to convert it to a renamed form where I don't have these old register architectural names. I have these physical names, where there's a different name for each version of a value. And to make this work, I'm going to have this table that maps the architectural names to my current version of that. Where is that stored in a physical register? And for my examples, I'm going to represent the physical registers as something with an X and a number, and the architectural registers like we do in x86 assembly with an R and something. I also am going to have a list of physical registers that are available for us to use for new versions of values. And you might say, gosh, what happens if this runs out of space? So part of the job of that commit stage, that sort of last cleanup step, is going to be to fill this back in with stuff that we aren't using anymore. So we're going to fill this in as we fully complete instructions. So let's do this renaming process. So I'm going to take my first instruction here, and I'm going to look up R10 here, and I'm going to find out R10 maps to R19. Great. I'm going to look up R8, and I'm going to find out R8 initially here mapped to X13. But I'm going to want to write a separate version number for the destination. So even though we have an operand that's source and destination, I really want to track the two different versions, so I'm going to rewrite the instructions to have a separate source, separate sources and destination. So that's why I've done that. So I needed a destination, and every new version of a value gets a new register. So in this scheme, we only write a physical register once. We never write it twice. Instead, we write it to a new register. So I take the first register off my free list and make that be the new RA current version. So then I have my next instruction. I'm going to say I want R11. That's going to be X07. I want to add that to R8, which is currently X18. And I'm going to put that result in a new version of R8, for which I'm going to take another thing off that free list. And so now the current version of R8 is X20. And I do the same process for our last instruction. And this is what we're going to put our instruction queue. And the advantage of this is now I can figure out, how to run this instruction. I say, I need to look for a value for x18 to run the second instruction. I don't need to worry about, do I have the right version of R8? I'm not looking at R8. I just say, do I have the right version of x18? Since we replace the physical registers every time we write a new value, if I have a value for x18, it is the correct value. There's only one. So all I need to track is, do I have a value for x18 or do I not? I don't need to track which one do I have. Yes?
So if we're only storing the most recently used physical register for each one in this table, then I don't really see how this gives any benefit in out of ordering. Because if this is the only thing that R8 is right now, then how can we ever use the other values or anything else?
Question, how can we use the old values if I'm only storing the mapping for the current value? We're going to store this first rename instruction here, right? And this tells us about X13, which is an old version of R8. So we haven't forgotten about the old versions of R8. We just have them in the instructions we put in the list of instructions to run. So that's how we're going to figure out, by looking at that list of instructions, how to use those old values. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Question, is there some bookkeeping that tells when we can free a physical register? Yes. The simplest way to think about it is when you see this here, that tells you X13 must not be used by any future instruction, and the commit stage is going to look at that information to figure out what's free. Yes?
Why does that tell you that it's not used by any future instruction?
Why does that tell you it's not used by any future instruction? So, any future instruction, by which I mean later instructions in the queue, not necessarily later run instructions, because they're run out of order, because X13 was the old version of R8, any future instructions would have used a different version of R8.
Okay, so even if R8 doesn't change, you would still, as in, okay, if these were add R8, R10, add R8, R11, add R8, R12, would those all be X13?
Question, if these instructions, if I swap the order of the operands, would they all use X13? And yes.
Okay.
And then we have different versions for R10, 11, and 12.
So then how do we know then when to free?
So question, how do we know when to free? So because I know the add instructions, because I know that X13 was the old value, the old version of the same register as X18, I can use that information to figure out anything after that's using it can't be using X13 because of how the assembly works. And that would be that kind of information the commit stage uses to free up registers. For the most part, we're going to kind of ignore the freeing up registers part and just assume we don't run out of space in the free list. But in practice, of course, that can happen. Yeah?
I know you've just been talking about this, but once you use rename X13 to X18, why can't you just put X13 on the free register list?
Question, why can't we put X13 on the free register list? Because we're not actually done. If we look at our pipeline, what we're doing here is we're filling up this. So we have something here that uses X13, but that's still there. And until that's actually finished running, we can't get rid of it.
But is the last step to put the new register back into X13 or something?
The question is the last step to put the new register back into X13. So in this renaming stage, we're filling up this queue of things to run later. So we've indicated I'm going to use X13 later and then use X18, but neither of these have happened yet. We're just planning.
Okay.
So when we want to free the registers is after we execute on this plan of taking these instructions we've renamed and actually running them. So let's do a little more complicated example. So I'll do our first step here. Want to rename this instruction. So here I'm going to take R10, which is X19, and X13, which I'm going to rename to X. Which I'm going to have a new version be named X18. So that's my first instruction. So then I have this next instruction, which is moving R8 to RAX. So I'm going to take R8, which is going to be X18, and I'm moving it not to RAX, the register, I'm moving it to location in memory. So I'm going to indicate that the value of RAX, X04, is an input to this instruction, not an output. We don't need a new version of RAX. We're going to use RAX to compute a memory location. And this instruction actually writes to memory. And we're going to have to keep that in mind when we figure out when we can run it relative to other instructions. And something you might think about with this code here is, gosh, what if RAX and 8 plus R11 are the same memory location? Isn't that something we need to deal with? It absolutely is. Because it could be the case that we need to make sure we run the first move, the store, before the load. And out-of-order processors need to deal with. So the simplest way of dealing with this is we run all the instructions that access memory in order, even though we run everything else out of order. A less simple way of dealing with it is we compare the addresses. And it turns out most processors use that second strategy, even though it is enormously complicated. Just because it is so much faster, it is worth the enormously complicated work of doing that. So then I have my subtract instruction. So X18, I have the same version of R8, and I have R11. I look up R11, it was X07. I make a new version of it, which is X20. That's what my next instruction is going to use to read. And we're going to write to yet another new version of R11, X21. Then I have this move instruction where we only write, so I only write and have a new version for that. So, and that's where I'm out of time. So we'll finish, go back to this next time and talk about our next step, which is, given that we've renamed these instructions, how do we figure out which ones to run?